Good afternoon, and welcome to Noon Edition. I'm WFIU News Director, filling in for Herald Times editor Bob Zaltzberg, who is away this week. In the studio with me is Mary Catherine Carmichael. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Will Murphy. You didn't even say your own name. Murphy, News Director.
I stand behind the title. What can I say? We have one guest for the program this afternoon. Our guest is Professor David Odrich. He is the director of the Entrepreneurship, Growth, and Public Policy Division of the Max Planck Institute of Economics in Germany. He is also the Emeritech Chair of – he holds the Emeritech Chair of Economic Development at IU. He is the director of the Institute for Development Strategies, and he teaches at the IU School of Public and Environmental Affairs. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Will. Thank you, Catherine.
It's very nice to have you with us this afternoon. Our topic is going to be the Entrepreneurial Society, which is the title – or at least part of the title of a new book by Professor Odrich. If you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, then the number in Bloomington is 855-0811. Toll-free outside the Bloomington area, 877-285-9348. And the email address, if you'd like to send us an email comment or question, is noon@indiana.edu. Now, let's just start off with the fundamentals of why you wrote this book. I mean, it's about the entrepreneurial society, and you're arguing for a new economic model working in the world. What's the idea behind it, and why did you write it?
Yeah, thanks, Will. Well, in some ways, I'm not as much arguing for a new economic model as suggesting one has emerged, is emerging, and we better be aware that it's here. And what the basis is, the old economic model, which is what we call in the book the managed economy, everything was pretty much in place. The firms, the jobs. Our job, our task in life was really to grow into them, get the education, to learn how to do what needed to be done to fill those existing jobs, those existing tasks in those existing firms. In the entrepreneurial society, which is a response to globalization, we've got to create things that don't exist. We've got to create jobs that don't exist. We've got to create tasks that don't exist. We've got to create firms that don't exist. It's all about change and thinking up, creating things that are valued by society globally but don't exist today. That's the difference.
Hasn't there always been this premise behind economic development that you think up the new widget, the new gadget, the new whatever it is that takes the market by storm?
Well, that's always been an element of it, but I think that for my generation and in the generation of the baby boom generation and their elders, we inherited an economy that was all about producing goods that already existed, that we knew existed, automobiles, steel, tires. Yes, it mattered to produce them better. But frankly, our focus was how do we produce them perhaps cheaply, more efficiently? There's a reason for that. After World War II, almost all of the capital stock, the machines, the factories, the plants were in America. I don't know, Will or Catherine, if you've ever been to Europe or to Germany or Japan. But if you go to, say, Berlin – you realize World War II just wiped it out. I mean, they lost not just their buildings, their schools. They lost their capital stock. It was not just Germany. It was all of Europe. Mm-hmm. So our starting point after the post-war, after World War II, we had it. They didn't have it. All we had to learn was how to operate us. In some ways, you could argue that made us fat and lazy. But in any case, you know, you're right to say innovation, entrepreneurship have always been important. In fact, in the book I argue, yeah, there's a very long tradition that goes to the core of this country, probably more than other countries. This is an entrepreneurial country. But in the post-war era, actually it was a managed economy where it was about managing what we had, not breaking away from what we were doing.
Now, you describe this new economy that's developing and this approach of the entrepreneurial society as a sort of proactive reaction or defense against globalization and outsourcing, which is implied by globalization.
Sure.
How is that true? How do we prevent or deal with outsourcing and globalization by taking this approach?
Well, I don't think we can prevent outsourcing and offshoring, especially the offshoring. I mean, we've always had the phenomena of outsourcing. In fact, Indiana has thrived on outsourcing to some degree. We've been suppliers of types of goods or products or inputs that were outsourced from Detroit. And that created a lot of jobs in Indiana, not just in Detroit, which was good for Indiana, good for the United States. As Tom Friedman points out in his book, the difference is now the outsourcing also tends to be offshored and tends to occur in places in such as India, China, Southeast Asia, but also Central and Eastern Europe. Now, we can't prevent that, or I don't think we should try to prevent that. That's actually good. I worked in a factory in high school to work my way through school and in college and an assembly line. That was tough, hard work. It took its toll on the men and women who worked in that factory, as it did through factories throughout the United States and throughout the West. To offshore that work is and give people an opportunity in other countries is a positive thing. But we've got to figure out always what's going to replace it. This is where the entrepreneurship comes in. We've got to take the opportunities we have, the assets, the resources, which more and more means ideas. Comes from education, comes from creativity, comes from thinking, from brain rather than just brawn, which is what you need to work in factories. Believe me, it was a long time ago, but I still remember going home with a sore arm, sore back, and seeing people. It just took a physical toll, which, by the way, we see in that mining incident in Minnesota too, right? I'm sorry, in Utah. That's brawn. And it takes a toll. Our competitiveness really has got to come from brain, from ideas. But it's not enough just to have the ideas. You actually have to act on them. That's where the entrepreneurship comes in. So that what the entrepreneurship does is it creates opportunities or takes advantage of opportunities for types of products, activities, companies, creates jobs that don't exist today. As soon as they become standardized, that means other people realize, oh, this is a good idea. They get copied. They get offshored. We got to stay one step ahead of the game.
Now, you referenced in that response Thomas Friedman, and for about the past year and a half, I mean, you couldn't walk into a room without somebody bringing that up and how we live in a flat economy, a flat world. A kid growing up in Shanghai or Mongolia has the same chance as a person growing up in Fishers, Indiana. But I get the impression that you take issue with Thomas Friedman on that. It's not a flat world.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't. What's great about globalization is that more and more people – as Tom Friedman says in his book, it's one of my favorite passages he says it used to be a couple centuries ago to do something international, to have interaction, you actually had to have the permission of your king or queen. That's what Columbus got. That's what Magellan got. Otherwise, you just stayed home. Century later, it was the same thing, but it wasn't the permission of your king or queen. It was really through a corporation, a multinational, international corporation. Now he says all you have to do is turn on the internet, the web, and you can connect. You can interact. It's clearly leveled the playing field so that people have opportunities. They're no longer geographically handicapped or disadvantaged. Well, it's true in this country too. You could be in a relatively isolated spot, say in North Dakota or down in the Southwest someplace, but you have access to things that you didn't have access before. What that means is the strategy for individuals, for places, and for firms in higher cost locations like the United States, like Indiana, like Bloomington says we've got to do something that other people aren't able to do elsewhere in the world. And that's what leads into can we engage in types of business, types of activity that are based on ideas that other people aren't able to create, think of, have access to do. That's the push towards an idea-based, an entrepreneurial economy. So in some ways, he's right. We start with this level playing field, but that's like saying, oh, the NFL has a level playing field. Clearly, some of the teams, one up in Indianapolis, by the way, at least last year, is clearly better than some of the other teams. So yeah, they've got a level playing field. But what their strategy is, what their actions are, makes a big difference, and that's what makes makes some places, some individuals able to take advantage of globalization, whereas other people in places get victimized by globalization.
Based on your response to this question and the last one also, I almost am getting a mental picture of the United States ideally, and tell me if you agree with this or not, as kind of a giant incubator, hatching ideas then that go out into the world, but that the incubator needs to be an ongoing process, not something that can really ever stop at this point.
You know that. Catherine, that's a wonderful analogy or metaphor for an incubator, but it's always got to be on the cutting edge of what's new, because people will always copy this. I mean, one of the striking things to those of us of a certain age is we remember when Elvis Presley was new and quite a shock to mm-hmm. society, right? And now we notice they play his music in the elevator in dentist office.
Painful, isn't it?
People yeah, – well, it is at the dentist office yeah. in any case.
Oh.
But people copy his music at weddings. They copy it. It's not just him, of course. It's the Beatles and so on. So I think it's that – it's – and you're capturing the – really the race that says when an idea proves to be good and there's example after example. For example, Starbucks coffee, this chain, right? That was new. Well, now we see all around the globe, we're seeing lots of other companies, people try to copy the idea that says, mm-hmm. oh, you can have high quality coffee in a similar kind of environment. Same mm-hmm. thing you could say with Ben and Jerry's ice cream. I remember when that was really the original high quality mm-hmm. ice cream, and now we see lots of people doing this good idea. So you're right to say our ability to create jobs, maintain jobs, especially high-quality, sustainable jobs in a high-quality standard of living. I think the standard of living that my generation inherited from my parents really depends on, as you said, having an incubation process that doesn't just create one new thing and then rests. In a way, that's probably why we like the sports metaphor at this time of year. The Indianapolis Colts won the Super Bowl, but you can see if they rest on that laurel that they won it last year, they're going to end up mediocre this year. They've got to keep thinking up something new, doing something different. Same thing for us in a global economy.
But no job is really or no business is really sustainable under this model because the change is constant.
You know, what did Bob Dylan write and sing in that song back when I used to have a little bit more hair? He said the slow one or the fast one now – will later be last. I think that's right. I think we can see example of after example of great company but also great location, successful location. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about companies like General Motors, I think for young people today, it's hard for them to imagine. But until the 1970s, certainly in the 1960s and 1950s, General Motors was the best company in mm-hmm. the world. It was the driving force of this country. It was the company that the world looked up to. Then what you had in the and now it's a question of will the company survive? Same thing with U.S. Steel. Uh-huh. If you look to IBM, looks like they're doing pretty well, but they had to get out of the computer business. They're now, of course, a service company. But you can see it for regions, one region or cities in our own state of Gary, Indiana. Gary used to be a thriving, prosperous city based on manufacturing steel. The world changed a little bit. They kept producing steel, and now it's one of the most depressed, cities in trouble in this country with a big challenge. There's lots of other examples. So you're right to say this has been a constant theme in certainly in economic history or in society. I do think that globalization accelerates the sense, mm-hmm. the pace of change. Our ability to hold a new idea, a new company, a new industry, it's all moving faster now.
Right. You think about it. At least two generations of people benefited from General Motors, from cradle to grave.
Yes.
So you see that as an opportunity of the past. Do you think things are going to change at such an accelerated rate that that's not even in the in our future anymore. Like the concept, remember the old concept we used to hear about being a company man?
Yes.
The company won't be around long enough to be a company man, so don't pull your full weight, put your full weight down. Is that what you're suggesting?
You know, it goes back to the first question Will asked when he said, well, why did I write the book and what does the Entrepreneurial Society mean? Well, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because a student came, a young woman, master's students came into my office about 5-6 years ago, and she started telling me about the difficulty she was having with her parents who couldn't understand why she couldn't just pick a direction, a career, join a company, stay with them her whole life, the way that her father had done. He'd been with Lilly Corporation her whole life. And you know, when you mentioned the company man, in fact, that was the credo. That was the formula that worked for most people.
And worked very well. Made it possible for them to raise families and put their children through college.
That's right. Gave them a sustainable life. And then if you couple that with your point, that doesn't work today. Or, you know, you may be able to find an example, but it's really going to be an exception. Mm-hmm. So there's a real generational shift away from people who thought, oh, I'm going to decide what job, what career, what company I'm going to have in my early 20s or late teens. I'm going to get that job and then I'm going to ride it. Mm-hmm. And maybe my kids will decide something else. But it would be one thing.
Yeah, and if I'm loyal to them, they'll be loyal to me. We'll take care of each other.
Yes, we'll take care of each other. There was a very famous book written by William White called The Corporation Man, and it was all about the pervasiveness of this company loyalty, this conformity. He argued it wasn't good for people, but one thing he didn't argue, this seemed to be good for the economy. It seemed to be good for business. And then your point, which is really the point I make in the book, whether that was better or worse, it's gone today. People have to deal with change as the rule. And that kind of permanence, stability, a lot of us have a kind of nostalgia for it. That's gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we were raised with that expectation. And so then we've got to make, as baby boomers, we've got to make a giant left turn that we weren't anticipating.
You know what, Catherine? That's great. And that's part of what's in the book. I think that there's lots of when you say expectations, I think that we all grow up with a kind of culture, a kind of set of expectations, a kind of sense of what's normal. Mm-hmm. So when the student came into my office –
or admirable.
Or that's right. And I think that what she was – and I noticed many of her classmates – by the way, also in my travels around the world, I can see the same tension arising really for the young generation in Europe as well as in this country, where their parents led a different life. They have different – or I should say we have different instincts, a different sense of what's the path, what's the formula, what's the way into the future, and our – as parents, as the older generation, are sure we want to convey this and we've been conveying this to our children, but it doesn't work anymore. That's one of the big reasons why I wrote the book. In fact, what we'll end up doing is conveying the wrong signals, the wrong messages to fool them to thinking security is one direction and a good standard of living, when in fact it's in a very different direction.
So we could inadvertently be doing them a disservice by trying to steer them into the old company man pattern.
Right.
Because
remember that old song by Cat Stevens? I'm sure
yeah,
I can tell.
I do.
You don't remember.
I
can tell you don't remember, Catherine. But you know, he said something like, it's not time to make a change. Find a girl. Settle down if you want. You'll be happy.
Yeah.
It's that idea of, yes, you can get this kind of stability, permanence. Mm-hmm. The paradox seems to be in the entrepreneurial society. By being open, receptive, embracing change, that's the path to security and stability.
Mm-hmm. And that puts a lot more responsibility on the individual because you're going to be responsible for making sure you have your own retirement set up because you're not going to be with the same company. You're going to be responsible for, in our country at least, making sure that you have health care. Do you see this having kind of a ripple effect in those kinds of institutions? Think about financial, health care, that sort of thing.
You know, that's a great question, Catherine. Again, it gets to really one of the big messages of the book, that post-war society, which is what I call the managed economy, that's what I really mean by the managed economy because most firms were really quite stable, quite permanent. Most people's working relationships, especially heads of family – by the time they're in their 30s and 40s, had very stable working experiences, that meant a lot of these social types of relationships, such as retirement, mm-hmm. health care, mm-hmm. even schools, education, community, all this kind of revolved around the stability of the worker-firm relationship. So your point is, as that becomes much more volatile, these old institutions don't work anymore. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have a healthcare crisis in this country. We clearly have education issues, if not a crisis in this country. We clearly have retirement issues. And the real bottom line is what you said. The onus is more and more on the individual than it certainly was for my generation or my parents' generation, where you had this sense much more of paternalism mm-hmm. that the company would take care of you, the government would take care of mm-hmm. you, somebody would take care of you. What's interesting is this isn't just this country where this shift is going on. It's happening all throughout the developed countries.
So, and we weren't necessarily trained for these changes. Go ahead.
Sorry to step in.
No.
I want to remind our listeners.
He's our guest today.
That's right. I want to remind our listeners that we're visiting this afternoon with Professor David Odrich. He is director of the Entrepreneurship Growth and Public Policy Division of the Max Planck Institute of Economics in Germany. Also the Emeritech Chair of Economic Development here at IU, Director of the Institute for Development Strategies, and he teaches in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs. If you'd like to join us in the program, we're talking about the topics raised by his new book, The Entrepreneurial Society. If you'd like to join us, the number here in Bloomington is 855-0811, toll-free 877-285-9348, and online you can drop your comments and questions to noon at indiana.edu. You've been talking about all these new models and the way that economics are changing globally. One of the standards has also been this question of cost and market and demand. And curiously, you argue that the folks who are going to go for lowest cost, companies that go for lowest cost, and one obvious example comes to mind, Walmart, are going to be dinosaurs, are going to be left out in the cold. How do you make that argument?
Well, Walmart – that's a very good point, because Walmart's strategy is based on low cost and they've out-competed or they're out-competing their rivals here in this country as well as globally as well. In some ways they've been very innovative and in a funny way very entrepreneurial by realizing very early on they could go to a new location on the earth, which was China, and really – take advantage of opportunities there to bring lower cost goods here. So I would – I'm sympathetic with people who say, oh, Walmart in its own way is actually a very innovative company. And what they're doing, of course, is offering much lower cost goods to consumers here than we could have had otherwise. It's a great thing for consumers. Now, what it's tough for is for people who are working in the retail business. Once again, that goes to show – if you're not doing jobs where you're working with ideas, working with your brain in some ways, you're going to be condemned probably to – you're competing basically with workers in China, India, Eastern Europe, Central Europe. It's very tough for you to keep your standard of living up. Sure, it's a company, Walmart. By the way, I would never want to say companies can't succeed by having a low-cost strategy. But they can't produce manufactured goods in this country with a low-cost strategy. That's for sure.
Just standing on that one leg is not going to do it.
It's not going to do it. They're going to have to be thinking of something other people aren't doing. Of course, that's exactly what Walmart did. They were really pioneers in realizing we can outsource and offshore. They were really pioneers at the degree they did, getting goods manufactured in China, bringing it in, which has benefited lots and lots of American consumers. It's real tough for the people working in the retail industry. And that's where that awareness of the entrepreneurial society, don't expect to have a livable, sustainable wage if you're in a Walmart company or some kind of retail that's basically competing on low cost. You need to be working in a company or some kind of activity which is based on your creativity, your ideas, your knowledge. If you can't do that, don't want to do that, then you've got to be prepared to probably be working for a wage that's going down and down and down.
So you don't think quality can be an equalizer? Here, let me give you an example of what I'm thinking of. My brother and sister-in-law own a tool and die making shop. They have a long history of making very good quality products, and they never claim to be the least expensive, but they claim to be the one that's going to last the longest and in the long run be the most cost effective. So now they're, of course, facing all kinds of folks who can make basically what they make, but for a lot less money. Will they last as long? No. And will they in the long run be the best price? Maybe, maybe not. Depends on how long that product is going to be manufactured. At any rate, this is kind of the situation that I think you're describing, but can quality triumph over cost?
Oh, absolutely. You gave an example. It can triumph over cost. You've got this race going between quality on the one hand, which increases the productivity of the consumers if it's an input, or increases the benefits to the consumers if it's a consumer good versus the lower cost. We see this all the time, say, in the automobile industry. We've got these high-quality goods coming in from Japanese auto producers, but we see pretty high-quality cars from other producers too that are lower cost. So it's always this trade-off. But your point is, for most manufacturers like your sister and brother-in-law in this country, their formula or their strategy is really going to have to be the quality or even the innovation strategy to try to make things that don't exist today.
Okay. We're going to pause for a moment, give Mary Catherine a chance to catch her breath and rehydrate. Our guest on Noon Edition this afternoon is David Audrich, professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs here at IU, and we're talking about Matters Economic. If you'd like to join us, we hope you will in the second half of this program. We'll be right back. I'm Will Murphy.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home office and garage, using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2 owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. And from South Dunn Street Project, represented by Brian Lappin Real Estate, classic bungalow-inspired architecture in the Bryan Park neighborhood of Bloomington, www.southdunnstreet.info. Speak Your Mind is WFIU's two-minute commentary, allowing you to air your thoughts about current global or local issues. To submit your idea or for a set of guidelines, you may call us at 855-1357 or visit our website at wfiu.org.
And welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Will Murphy, filling in this afternoon for Herald Times editor Bob Salzberg. Mary Catherine is here in the studio with us as well. And our guest is Professor David Audrich of the School of Public and Environmental Affairs here at IU. He holds the Emeritech Chair of Economic Development and also is Director of the Institute for Development Strategies, and in his spare time is Director of the Entrepreneurship, Growth, and Public Policy Division of the Max Planck Institute of Economics in Germany. If you'd like to join this conversation, please feel free. The number in Bloomington is 855-0811. Toll free outside the Bloomington area, 877-285-9348. And the email address, and we have an email or two to get to in just a moment, is noon@indiana.edu. David, we might start up the conversation during the second half of the program by trying to localize this and make it a bit more concrete. Here in Bloomington, there's often the discussion about developing an arts economy, developing an entertainment economy. People talk on a council about a living wage and using, it sounds like, a lot of the ideas you're talking about. You talk about proximity, folks getting together and collectively, like they do in Silicon Valley, for example, reaching a sort of critical mass. Can you speak to how Bloomington, for example, is reflective of the kind of ideas you talk about in your book?
Sure. When I worked in the factory back in the old managed economy, your value as a worker was almost independent of who was working around you. It was really dependent on the machines, the factories you had to work with. So when a worker – and I knew people. They'd leave, say, Cleveland in a steel mill, go to Detroit in an automobile mill – automobile plant, they basically do it to get a higher wage. Mm-hmm. It didn't really have to do with the people that much. Once you start working with ideas, but also your intuition, also your instinct, you're trying to draw on your creativity, really try to draw on your spirit as a person, then the value of – or really your ability to think of new ideas – your ability to learn, your ability to be creative depends crucially for most of us on the people around us. Back in the 60s, we used to say you are what you eat. Maybe that's true. But I think in the entrepreneurial economy, your ideas and your ability to act on them depends on the people around you. And you know what that says? It's really important to creative people, to entrepreneurial people, to be in a cluster where there's other people who are like them, complementary to them, have a similar kind of spirit. And that's why these clusters, entrepreneurial clusters, become so important. It's a big shift where it's – we move from really a non-personal economy to where your value in a way, but also your satisfaction as a person depends on the people around you. So for Bloomington, what does that mean? Well, Bloomington, like any place, has some liabilities and some assets. One of the – I mean the liabilities you could argue is relative isolation relatively. Its size – a lot of us think it's an asset. Some people say, yeah, but it's not a big city, so that's always limiting. I guess the ocean and the mountains here are not particularly noteworthy, right? But the assets we have is – of course, a very creative university with a lot of interesting people, a long tradition of music, arts, and literature, so that this is an asset that Bloomington as a place can really is building on. I think that's right, which is can we have a cluster of creative people, including artists, but also musicians. And this is not only makes for an interesting, vibrant place, it's good business. It's strong, solid business investment because out of this creativity comes a lot of interesting businesses, industries, and sustainable jobs.
You made a reference to the university, and obviously that is a big fish in this economic pond. And there is quite a cluster of creative, accomplished, intelligent people. What role do you see more generically for the university in this entrepreneurial society that you describe?
I don't know, Will, if you ever heard of the movie Breaking Away. But Mary Catherine clearly has. You remember that movie? You had a sense of the university, actually this university, as being isolated, aloof, distant. The wall, invisible wall between the town – of course they called the Cutters back then – which referred to the generation of young people whose dads cut the limestone that ironically were used for the buildings of this university. There was an invisible wall, and that's really what the movie's about. Somehow almost like a Romeo-Juliet sense. These are two different rival groups. Certainly when I spent the 1970s as an undergraduate, then as a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, it wasn't just IU and Bloomington. That was true in Madison. Mm-hmm. We were proud. The university was proud. We didn't want to have anything to do with the community. We were a world unto ourselves. And you know, I think that the communities, just as was portrayed in Breaking Away, they were pretty happy that we kept our distance. That was this wall. Well, you know what? That made sense at that time because what could the university really contribute to an economy that was based on manufacturing cars, steel, rubber? Like I say, when I worked in a plant, having a college degree, all that would do would get in your way. The last thing in the world you wanted to do was to think about ideas. The whole key to working in a manufacturing plant was don't think about anything. Keep your mouth closed. Do what you're told. Obey the rules. All you're learning in higher education was to question things, challenge things, so that in a world where we knew what had to be produced, who was going to produce it, how to produce it, the university really was seen more as a luxury. Yes, we needed the university for democracy, for society, for the furtherment of Western civilization or civilized values. But as as an investment into the economy, it was seen as a consumption, as a luxury kind of a good. I think that's the way pretty much all of the West viewed the university. Well, something changed. That change is reflected in the the start of Michael Crichton's book, Jurassic Park. If you go back and look at the book, he starts something along the lines. He says biochemistry used to be an irrelevant subject, better left to the meanderings of irrelevant professors wearing tweed jackets in the ivory tower. And then one day it became valuable. Then he starts it with the DNA, mm-hmm. the dinosaurs and so on. Well, what happened is with globalization, as our competitiveness shifted away from brawn to just working in manufacturing companies, increasingly to being based on ideas, the source of ideas becomes important. One of the important sources of ideas is the university. So suddenly the role of the university shifts from what we saw in Breaking Away to an important institution, important source of ideas that's important not just for companies but for people, for all of society, not just for democracy and social reasons, cultural reasons, but really to generate the firms, the companies, the jobs of the future. So suddenly we have a different – not suddenly, but it's evolved. It's not just Indiana University. I mean universities all across this country but also across the world now are perceived very differently. Our task, yes, it's to contribute to democracy, to civilization, to culture, but it's also to give society return in terms of ideas for the investment they're making in the universities. And that's how Indiana University, like most other universities, is changed over time.
Okay. We have other questions coming from that, but we also have some emails.
Yep. This one begins, could you please define exactly what you mean by entrepreneurship? For example, do you include those people who create small businesses on a local scale? For example, the local homemade ice cream shop, the clothes boutique owner, the local guitar shop, or are you referring to something else more on a global scale, that is, companies that are created by motivated individuals who are somehow frustrated by their previous employment and who have ideas that can't or won't be implemented in that arena. Those who then venture out to create their own company or firm with the desire to go global or at least make a profit.
Well, thanks very much, Mary Catherine, for reading that question. Thanks to the listener for sending that in. That question really gets to the heart of two issues. What is entrepreneurship and why do people do it? The what is in its essence, it's people start – it's two things. One is it's a kind of behavior. It's a kind of orientation. It's a kind of an attitude. That's vaguer. But more concretely, you can focus it on starting a business. So the answer to that first part of the question is yes, certainly it's people starting ice cream shops mm-hmm. and bakeries and so on. The second part seems to suggest the motivations why people do it. And I think the motivations why people will start a business is as varied as why the motivations why people get married. They do it for all kinds of different reasons. Sometimes – and it's important. Sometimes they are frustrated. They feel they can't get their ideas across in some existing organization. Sometimes they feel like they have an idea that they just want to pursue. Nobody else is interested. But that in itself is crucial and tells you why entrepreneurship is so important. Because ideas are so precious in this society – just the way that coal was steel was precious in an earlier economy, we can't afford to let ideas just sit idle unused. So that when somebody has an idea and says, if I can't pursue it in this organization, this firm, this context, then I'm going to go start my company mm-hmm. and I'm going to pursue my idea. Sometimes it'll – and what actually – the third part of the question says, well, does the outcome influence whether it's entrepreneurial or not? Scholars, for what it's worth, really argue about this. My answer is no, it doesn't matter the outcome. What matters is the activity. The fact is it's entrepreneurial activity. Just like marriage, some marriages work better than others. We know that. But the fact is they're all marriages. Some entrepreneurial activity generates a more positive outcome than other entrepreneurial activity, but it's still entrepreneurial activity.
Okay. Here's a couple of follow-ups to that from the same writer. Are there characteristics or personality traits that define a successful entrepreneur? Is there a kind of character profile? I've read that most successful entrepreneurs have had several failed businesses under their belts, which would signal to me that many entrepreneurs are focused yet flexible and definitely risk-takers. And are they probably very savvy about putting themselves in situations where they can take advantage of opportunities? opportunities, such as getting sourcing from venture capitalists. Could you elaborate?
If I could just interject here, we might tie into that this whole question of the global generation as a character type.
Oh, that's great. Thanks, Will. I think historically there's always been and certainly the way the scholars went about it was to – we ask – speaking from Bloomington, Indiana, Indiana University, the home of Kinsey. Kinsey asked the famous question, who does it and who doesn't do it? Well, scholars have asked the same question about entrepreneurship, the it, of course, meaning not Kinsey's it, but the it mm-hmm. of starting a business. Mm-hmm. And their first impulse, which really has lasted till about this day, has been to focus on there must be something different about the people. Maybe it's they're short. Maybe it's they're tall. Maybe it's they're old. Maybe it's they're young. Maybe it's they're male. Maybe it's they're female. Well, all these things that are about – it's about the people. So that when more recently as places, cities, towns, countries – have felt they have a deficit of entrepreneurship, they say, oh, we've got the wrong people. If we had the right people, they'd be more entrepreneurial. I've heard this said in the context of Germany. There's this sense of the trouble with the reason why there's a deficit of entrepreneurship in Germany, somehow they're the wrong kinds of Germans. If we had the right kind of Germans, they'd be more entrepreneurial. I've heard the same thing in Indiana, by the way, that somehow people on the coast are somehow more entrepreneurial. I think that it's a very – I wouldn't want to say individual characteristics don't have anything to do with it. But I think what's more interesting is the environment actually and that what are the incentives, the opportunities, the constraints. I think this probably is a bigger reason why people become entrepreneurs rather than their own inherent characteristics, mm-hmm. which is to say you take somebody, we'll just say in a sleepy town in North Dakota, maybe they're not entrepreneurial in any sense. Put them perhaps in Silicon Valley. You haven't changed their characteristics. What you've done is changed their opportunities but also their ability to act. And going back to this sense of, well, maybe we don't have the right kind of Hoosiers in Indiana, the right kind of Germans in Germany. Go out to Silicon Valley and among other kinds of people, you'll see all kinds of Hoosiers and all kinds of Germans. Mm-hmm. The problem isn't so much the people. I think the issue for places because an entrepreneurship policy is key to the economic development strategy of places says how can you harness the aspirations of people so they're entrepreneurial – not some other place but in this place.
Mm-hmm. Can one sort of extrapolate from that when you speak of the global generation and the environment that they live in, that they've just grown up in a sort of global environment in which the Heisenberg principle plays a large part? I mean they're always uncertain about what's coming up. There's always something new. There's something different and their parents didn't have that world. They don't get it.
You know, Will,
looking at I think it was Amazon, one of the folks who was reading your book said, this book has been really great helping me talk to my parents. It was like a translator, which I thought was interesting.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I appreciate you bringing up this sense that there's a global generation. Perhaps it's just a sign of my own maturing process. But I notice most places, almost every place I go around the world and talk with young people, they seem to have more and more in common. Compared to when I was young, there seemed to be a much greater distinction between, say, people growing up in Spain or people growing up in Argentina or people growing up in China. Clearly, this is because of the web, the internet, mm-hmm. the communications. But I think especially for this country, I think that there's the young generation who are students here in Indiana and elsewhere in the country. I think that there's a very different view of America, what it means to be American. Of this young global American generation that is true of their parents where they feel they're in the world like other people in the world but they're not necessarily better or first among equals as I think was true of older generations. And I think that, Will, what you suggest is that, it's the access to information, technology, every place that in a way gives – people all around the world a more equal chance.
All right. Here's another email that came in. It begins, hello, I'm from Delhi, India. Could David tell us if entrepreneurial society is something that is relevant only to the United States?
Well, I appreciate that question very much from the listener. The answer is no, and it's come as a kind of a shock, especially in Europe where I work and do a lot of research and lecturing. I think that the Europeans, but also to some degree most of the world, had felt that, well, somehow this Silicon Valley phenomena that emerged in the 90s, this seemed to be uniquely American. But what we're seeing now is that as Europe, the other developed countries are hit by globalization, mm-hmm. the same way we've been hit.
Right.
They're no more immune to it than we are. That their response has been to go to create an entrepreneurial society just the way we have. It leads to – so it's just as valid for developed countries, and we're also seeing in developing countries such as India, certainly China as well. This is a way for individuals, you know, as you said, Mary Catherine, for individuals to take their destiny in their hands mm-hmm. rather than to passively take what's handed them by existing companies or governments. So this seems to be a global phenomenon. Huh.
I was talking to a guy yesterday who heads up the Indiana Youth Institute, a guy named Bill Stanjakevich, who studies youth issues in Indiana. And he said his organization surveyed parents about what their number one concern for their kids was. And he said overwhelmingly the answer was, how am I going to make sure my kid does well in the future? What am I going to do to ensure success? Now, if you're talking to a parent in Indiana from the vantage point of the entrepreneurial society, what do you do? What do you have to put in place to foster, if not guarantee, the success of your kid?
Yeah, I, as a father of three, I appreciate that question, Will, and have the same concern. I have the same question myself, so yeah. I'd like to ask it. But you know, I would recollect a different movie from the 1960s, The Graduate. And remember the opening scene Mary Catherine, where a startling young Dustin Hoffman actually is graduating from college, isn't quite too sure what to do, and a well-meaning family friend whispers in his ears. Well, Mary Catherine already gave away the punchline. Plastics, right? And notice that was the point was he was well-meaning, said do this and you'll get – you'll get success in a future.
Life, yeah.
I think what stayed the same over time, parents, the older generation has always been, thank goodness, concerned about exactly that question. How can we provide a future for our young people? That gets right back to where we started off at the beginning of the discussion, right, Mary Catherine?
Yeah.
The formula that worked just a generation ago. Go into plastics, go into autos, go into steel, go into something secure, and this will then you've got it made, is exactly the wrong message. So, Will, the answer to that question, my sense is prepare kids for change. Prepare them to be to deal with diversity, diverse situations, different situations. Prepare them to get them used to moving around. Get them used mm-hmm. to thinking about the world in a bigger sense. Travel probably becomes more important. Mm-hmm. I never had a passport till I was 30 years old. I didn't ever think I'd have one. I didn't even fly an airplane till I was 21. I'm a real product of my generation. You know, most of us don't raise our kids this way. I think that we can feel the future of our kids depends on nourishing their creativity, nourishing their independence, nourishing their inner spark, because their ability to thrive really is based on linking up what's in them to the outer society. That's very different. If I can just finish by saying, my mom passed away a few years ago, and as I was cleaning out her basement, I found her my report card from the first grade, something like 1959, 1960, and I was shocked, Will, and Mary Catherine, how bad my grades were. I would have thought I was a better student, but I was equally shocked at what I was graded on, at least in upstate New York, 1959, 1960, obeys orders, gets mm-hmm. along with others, does what he's told, is reliable. It's very clear, at least back then, people thought that the success for the next generation depended on keeping your mouth shut, doing what you're told, obeying the rules, conforming, then you become one of William White's corporation men if mm-hmm. you were lucky enough to have a white collar, mm-hmm. work on in a factory if you had a blue collar. Either way, you'd make a good, sustainable middle class livelihood. That formula doesn't work anymore. That's where I go back to, and I think that's the way we are raising our children now. creativity, independence, thinking for yourself, because as Mary Catherine said before, they're going to have to use their own resources, mm-hmm. but also link it up to what Will was saying with networks, clusters with other people to kind of forge ahead in the future, almost the way American pioneers and immigrants did this generations ago.
I read a book recently by Dr. Greg Sipes, and he said he was talking to a friend who is raising children, and they said, "I wish I would have spent more time preparing my children for the road and less time preparing the road for my children."
You know, the great German philosopher Goethe wrote one time, "The greatest thing a father can give his son is roots, so he knows where he comes from." That makes sense. Those are the kids. The second greatest thing is wings to escape them.
Yeah.
And I think that goes to show this idea isn't so new, right?
Yeah.
We've only got a minute or two left here, and we wanted to ask before we wrap up this program, why so much music reference in the book?
Yeah. It was really the generation of the 1960s, just a little bit ahead of my time, that was raised to continue to take on, to take over the managed economy. They were the ones who were raised in the late 50s, early 60s. They went to the proms. They listened to Elvis Presley. They watched Ozzy and Harriet on the Leave It to Beaver on the television show and so on. They're the ones who rebelled against that managed economy. The music that came with that, like Bob Dylan, was a music that was focused on rebelling against the managed economy, rebelling against all those values I was talking about, conformity, doing what you're told and so on, and instead put the emphasis on creativity, emotion, instinct, and intuition. That's why that music, I think, is almost a starting point for the emergence of the entrepreneurial society.
Okay. We are going to have to leave it there. If you want to find out more about the lyrics and some of the premises behind the Entrepreneurial Society, we advise you to maybe go check out the book written by our guest today, Professor David Aldrich. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
On behalf of Mary Catherine Carmichael, editor Bob Salzberg, producer Aaliyah Mood, and engineer Mike Pashkash, I'm Will Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times.